This is the Saxo Market Call, the daily financial markets podcast, across asset classes and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It's Friday, 31st of March, 2023. Here we are, finally, end of quarter, end of Japanese financial year. We'll be talking about that. But in yesterday's action, seeing an extension of the rally, but I think more and perhaps more compelling or interesting to investigate here than that fact is the divergence in the big stocks moving up and the main indices looking quite strong. But underneath the surface, things not looking quite as good. And, you know, with this local focus here on banks, of course, due to the recent turmoil, especially the regional banks, I noticed I pulled up that index and it gapped higher at the open and sort of sold off all day and closed on the lows and below the previous day's close here. So that that headline that the NASDAQ is posting its highest level since last August and what is so far a technical breakout to the upside did not actually hit 13,000 on the cash, although the future is trading well above that for the June future. Yeah, so some divergences, Peter, is basically the long and short of what I'm trying to say here, and I think that's the most compelling thing to look at.
Yeah, you can see on slide two, I put in the global industry group's 1 month's performance there, and I think it's quite interesting to see, you know, banks, energy, real estate, quite cyclical, also car makers, very cyclical, high beta to the economy, industry groups being down, and then you have the rest of the market, and especially in, if you look at the top four, the gang of four, you can call them maybe the semiconductors, media and entertainment. So you have Netflix, Disney, Meta sitting in there, and Google sitting in that segment. Then technology hardware, that's where Apple is sitting, and then software, where you have Microsoft and Nvidia sits in the semiconductors. So of course, those four industry groups are responding to the lower interest rates. Also, a lot of the, you know, excitement and optimism around AI systems like GPT-4, of course, are driving a lot of the actions among these mega caps in the technology sector. But I just find it quite startling, John, because we have tighter credit conditions. The banks, the whole physical world that we know sits in the banking system. So when you have a shock like this, I mean, it sends a very important signal about the economy and the rest of the world. And then you have the digital sphere of the equity market just, doesn't really matter and just pulling ahead. So I think that's an interesting divergence that we have seen this month.
Yeah, it certainly is. And on that note, with the credit risks going forward, there was the Fed's Kashkari, a voter this year, out talking about they're uncertain of the impact and it's going to take some time to assess, blah, blah, blah. But there is this ongoing march into money market funds by depositors to get better yields. The latest data point I saw was a plus $304 billion. I'm actually not sure if that's a week or a month. Apologies for that. But that the total has gotten up to $5.2 trillion. And of course, the more this happens, the more that the banks are losing their funding and will have to pay up if they want to compete with money markets for interest rates, et cetera, and the risk, of course, into credit and that feeding into the economy in a classic credit cycle. So, yeah. Clear that the risk on the credit crunch size is it brings forward and potentially deepens the eventual recession that could be incoming here. And then the equity markets are doing their own thing right now, celebrating lower rates, I suppose, is the lazy way to look at it. But valuation-wise, we're still pretty elevated levels, as you're bringing up here on the next slide, slide three.
Yeah, I mean, if we compare it over the past 12 years, I mean, outside the crazy pandemic years with all the stimulus and galloping equities, especially with as interest rates just got to rock bottom levels, so all the high duration companies were flying. So if we strip that out, we still have some of the highest levels we have seen for the cycle since the Great Financial Crisis, and you just have to wonder that it just displays a remarkable risk sentiment on equities, which is essentially the future because equities are pricing growth and profitability. And as we talked about yesterday, you know, we're sitting at all-time highs in terms of profit margins for companies. So if you believed in the mean reversion nature of this, which has been the case for 70 years, why wouldn't it happen again? Then there will be considerable headwinds for companies going forward. They will be more difficult to maintain those high profit margins. So it feels a little bit like we're sitting at an uncomfortable risk-reward entry point level here in the equity market. So, but it is what it is. I just want to flag it. I just find it very interesting that we have been able to come back as far as we've had already.
Yeah, you can draw parallels to some previous cycles. For example, back in 2001, early 2001, the surprise rate cut from Greenspan that saw a 13.5% advance in one day in the equity markets, or at least in the NASDAQ on that day. And then we saw the 2007, that last little sprint to the broad average S&P 500 cycle highs as we were about to crater into the financial crisis. We're not trying to draw complete parallels, but there is going to be sometimes when you see the forward easing shaping up, the market's initial reaction function when the immediate pressure isn't there on the economy is perhaps to celebrate that net easing to financial conditions, at least in terms of forward expectations from policymakers. So it's really curious to look at, as we show on slide four, what the market is saying here. And the market is saying that the Fed is going to peak soon, will be cutting perhaps as soon as the July or the September meeting. I put in the interest rate probability forward expectations for the Fed there on slide four. It's a couple days old, but there's not been any meaningful change since the 28th when I took that snapshot. You see the two-year rate there in the background. And yet, the Fed is supposedly set to start cutting, and quite soon, despite this inflation dragon not yet having been slain. If you look at the PCE, which I have there on the right, so the gray sort of choppy figures of the month-on-month readings, that 0.6 was quite hot for January. That was the most recent one. We have, of course, February's data point today expected at 0.4%, which would be right around that six-month average. So for six-month average, core inflation is running at annualized around 5%. The Fed funds rate being chopped and chopped rapidly, I think there's a dissonance here. The only way we can realize that Fed outcome is if we have a very ugly march into a recession and clear signals from the economy that the economy is in distress. Claims are up, unemployment is rising, these types of classic cyclical things that would have the Fed concerned on the employment front and continued and pretty powerful disinflationary signals at the same time. So it's a bold bet on the forward curve, I would say, on the market's behalf here, and very interesting to see how that shapes up in the coming few months as these data points roll in. All right, then if we roll forward to FX, again, as noted, end of the Japanese financial year today, we had the yen on its back foot overnight despite a very hot Tokyo March CPI reading out of Japan. I don't think that's what's distracting traders at the moment. I think there are a lot of flows into year-end hedging for the year forward. The general strength and risk sentiment is also a yen negative at the margin. And we have, the yen weak and weaker than a relatively weak dollar here. As you can see, those momentum readings on the two-day and five-day on our FX board on slide five for the yen really losing speed here. But will this change in the new year? And I think if we look 3 months, 6 months, 1 year forward, that there has to be some kind of convergence in Bank of Japan policy with the rest of the world, whether that is because the Bank of Japan moves in the direction of tightening, which I think it will. But also, if it doesn't, then it would have to be because we're realizing a much worse economic slowdown than we anticipate, and the rest of the world is coming down closer to Japan's level. So just something to note here. And of course, we have a new Bank of Japan governor also coming on board in a week's time. And to me, that euro-yen price looks rather high on what I think the potentialities are around convergence of policy to some degree in the coming sort of not next week or the next 2 weeks, but the multi-month time frame and longer. Otherwise, FX pretty quiet here. The dollar slightly on its back foot, as noted. Again, no big surprise when we have strong risk sentiment here and the Fed quite complacent on where the market quite complacent on where the Fed is headed. All right, there's actually for a relatively quiet day in the market. So we did see the new highs in the equities yesterday in the U.S., but there's a lot of little stories bubbling around. You've brought up a couple things there on slide six, but I have to mention here, we just saw President Trump being indicted by a grand jury on charges. The headlines are that these are the charges related to those hush money payments to a woman during the 2016 campaign to prevent her from selling her story of their dalliance or affair, whatever you want to call it, 10 years prior. But if you start to read closely, we don't really know what the specific charges are and won't know those. I'm not sure I understand all the legalese around when those charges become public. But the one Bloomberg article I was reading says this could be part of, quote, part of a larger case of falsifying business records in annual financial statements. So if it's specifically related to the hush money, I'm suspecting that it's going to be easy for the Trump side to position this as a witch hunt, etc. But if it's more serious charges of cheating on taxes and on reporting financially, and this is just sort of an entrance angle to all that, then this could be a more interesting setup here. Regardless, I think it's just a sign of the times and a sign of and a risk of a massive and growing divide across U.S. society as this story develops. And it's probably going to just continue to snowball into the 2024 election season. So, yeah, it's kicking off another round of political mess in the U.S. I think it's easy to say. But, Peter, onto your stocks to watch today and this very interesting Tesla story. Take us through that. I think it's the most compelling thing to look at out there otherwise.
Yeah, so Tesla is pursuing to build a very large EV battery plant in the U.S. in a partnership with CATL, which is the short name for Contemporary Amprix Technology Limited in China. Very long name there, but CATL being the world's largest battery manufacturing and the key champion and leader in these iron phosphate batteries, which are very popular because it's so they much cheaper to produce than the lithium ion batteries. They have lower energy density for now. So they don't provide the same range and recharge capabilities. So but they have become popular because they can reduce the price point and thereby accelerating demand and volume growth. So Tesla is in talk. They apparently a lot of talks with the White House. They want to be absolutely sure about that their interpretation of the rules in the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act is correctly interpreted in relation to getting these subsidies for this plant. Tesla's right now on a very, very big investment spree here. $22 billion they're investing. They're really ramping up their business. And the move is very similar to the one that Ford Motor announced recently with CATL. And before you jump in the conversation here, John, because you said before we went into the studio, why are we pursuing these partnerships when you have this very obvious friction between the U.S. and China? And what is Tesla thinking and what is the U.S. thinking? And I said back to you, well, from a U.S. point of view, I don't think they have any problem with having a technology partnership with CATL building a physical plant in the U.S. And in fact, it is actually the Chinese that are worried this time around. We used to that it's typically the Americans and the Europeans that are afraid of technology steel or whatever when they do the partnerships in China. But this time around, it's the other way around. The Chinese government is really arguing that they want to get more information from Ford Motor and CATL to ensure that no technology will be shifted away during this partnership. So I think that's an interesting story in itself. And you wanted to say something, I think, on the battery side.
Yeah, it's just to point out it is a lowered energy density, but they're moving fast on improving the energy density of that. And it was the story I mentioned yesterday, this new round of a so-called Qilin battery, which can achieve a far superior density relative to the prior cells. And they say that they can build 100-plus kilowatt-hour batteries, which would have ranges even beyond what the longest-range Teslas have today. Of course, that must be a stonkingly large battery that weighs a heck of a lot, but still, it is a really interesting story. And I agree. After our conversation, it's more. Will the Chinese allow CATL to invest this amount of money into plant, a productive plant in the U.S.? And that'll be what's to watch, I guess, in the coming months on this. But yeah.
And it's also the technology on batteries is fascinating. There's so many different paths that we are going. Also, the semi-solid that we talked about with Freyr battery, which is
24mm is the key technology. Yeah,
exactly. They bought this Norwegian company, and they are apparently ramping up production as we speak. So
and another player with some figures on power density that were even further off the chart. There's so much going on technologically in this battery space. It's really really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting. I was about to say something, but otherwise this podcast will just run very low. We'll do that another time. And Netflix is the other story that I find very interesting. So it's out with news that it's consolidating its film unit. Some of the executives in the unit, which has been with the company for 15 years, are leaving the company. They're doing it to cut costs. And we have to think back that, some of the reasons why Netflix originally did go into movie production with their original content was because there were fears at Netflix that some of the studios, Hollywood studios, would cut off Netflix from content. And that's why they launched this original content spree. And I think what happened is that they fought off that threat from the studios. The studios remained with Netflix, and now the ecosystem around streaming has changed considerably. There are more different streaming services, so there's not only Netflix, so the studios are no longer afraid that they are going to operate or partner with a monopoly, so there's a much better healthy distribution ecosystem for the studios, and that has removed the threat for Netflix. And it's just very difficult to do this movie production. As I was thinking this morning that You know, if you go back in the time, so Standard Oil, they wanted to be in the refinery business because it was very stable business, and they let the risk takers do all the oil drilling. So they took the risk with their capital and time, and I think that it's the same with Netflix and movie production. It's very risky to do original content because sometimes you can lose that vibe and that creativity and creating the good movies or the good TV series. So I think it's the right move for Netflix here. And as you can see on slide 6, horrible performance on the share price. It has recovered some of the ground, and I think this will continue to be a tailwind for Netflix. In terms of the earnings releases, slide 7, I didn't even bother to highlight one of them in blue. I think all these names, sorry, are not very interesting for the market, but we put them up there. Some of the listeners here might have shares in those companies and are interested in that. So I put up a 12-month trailing EBITDA chart on Stoxx 600 and S&P 500 because we're only 2 weeks away from the Q1 earnings season, which will be very interesting. We'll be watching this margin compression, looking for the outlook. And I actually find this chart very interesting. So you have the operating income side of things in the S&P 500 stalling a little bit here in the last couple of quarters, while it's galloping higher in Europe. We have not seen an earnings growth in Europe like this in many decades. And I think it's a little bit at odds with, you know, we're seeing these riots in Paris, and, you know, we have the war in Ukraine, and you know, we have Germany a little bit on the back foot, all these things. But things are actually doing quite well in the European corporate sector.
Yes, and perhaps not what you would have expected going into the post-invasion of Ukraine with the energy spike, certainly, and all of these other factors bears watching. And unfortunately, I think it's going to be this quarter we're entering into now, not unfortunately, but that will be perhaps more pivotal in terms of the trajectory for the economy, if that's when the credit crunch starts to bite. But rolling forward to the macro calendar on slide 8, we have the Eurozone March preliminary CPI up today. We've seen some interesting figures elsewhere. That Spanish CPI is still at 7.5% at the core year-on-year. That was versus 7.6% expected, but still a very high core level given the ECB policy rate. Today's Eurozone reading expected at 5.7%. That would be slightly higher than the February 5.6%. So watching that and watching the PC inflation, as noted earlier, that is expected at that 0.4% month-on-month level. Another hot reading really, I think, again, challenges that forward view on the Fed here, which just has to keep to some level is, of course, its eye on the inflation ball. Finally, a couple of these Fed speakers out oddly late today for a Friday, and the next week shaping up to be critical for U.S. incoming data with the ISMs, ISM services in particular, but also the jobs report on Friday, and two central bank meetings, the Australian, where we're expecting the pause to finally happen. That's the consensus around that. And then the contrast with the RBNZ, which is expected to go another quarter percent hike, taking the rate to 5%, so well above Australia's 3.6%. And that divergence is about as extreme as I think it can get, but there is a little bit more hiking in the future priced in for the RBNZ. Are they going to move towards a more cautious stance and a pivot here as well? Some of the New Zealand indicators are very, very weak. I'm a bit surprised at how their forward curve is positioned relative to the backdrop there, but let's have a look at those. That'll be an interesting contrast and what the action looks like in Aussie Kiwi across next week. All right. I think it's a session worth watching today for sure after this break in the NASDAQ 100 above technical levels that were so important of late. Does that break hold? Do these divergences mean anything? Still have to keep our eye on the banks, etc. And plenty to look at next week as well. So we'll keep you posted. Have a great weekend, and we'll be back next week with a Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter at Saxo Market Call, or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.